bring it all the way down to John Dewey and even down to Jim Jeffords. You know, my Declaration of Independence, I view as sort of related to
related
this.
Related to that.
It's a fascinating kind of thing for one little state up here, you know, with a population of 600,000 and a history, you know, that goes back. Yeah. To have this kind of rich intellectual history is, I just think it's phenomenal. And I'm just scratching the surface. I'm by no means that.
You might want to look at, you know, part of Tom Bassett's book, too, there, that, and I don't remember the which chapter it is directly, but I can go home and look at it. But there's one or two chapters in there that would speak, I think, really to the essence of what Ethan Allen's trying to get to, which might be
I found that book very helpful. And then there is a book that's actually a PhD thesis called Frontier Rebel, Ethan Allen, Frontier Rebel. Yeah,
that's fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, you've read that one?
Yeah.
Wow. Not many people have read that book.
Well,
it's out.
I published a magazine about Vermont history for a while.
Oh, well, that's why you know so much. I'm thinking.
She knows so much about so many things.
Yeah. And that's now out in paperback. There's a 1995, which I've got this from the library, Revolutionary Outlaws, which he wrote. They have over the UVM library his PhD thesis, which is the longest PhD thesis I think I've ever seen. It runs, it's 900 pages long.
Wow.
And so, have you seen his?
Yeah, I have.
It's huge. Yeah, the book is long enough, but it's very well written. And he's actually the one that turned me on or pointed me in the direction of immortality as being the main reason why Ethan wrote the book, because it is puzzling why he wrote the book. I mean, he wasn't applying for a teaching job anywhere where you had to publish or perish. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like he wanted to be a minister or anything. What was in it for him in publishing this book? And I think it was that chapter on the soul and immortality. And this writer is the one that first pointed me in that direction, because he talked about the life changes that Ethan had been through and the fact that he almost died many times. I mean, many times. The fact that he survived that expedition to Montreal is incredible, because he was on the brink of being executed, literally on the brink of being executed. And when they spared his life, he actually offered himself in place of, they were going to kill some of his men. He was a genuine hero. I mean, he was rough around the edges, but he was willing to lay down his life at any moment, you know.
Wasn't he under sentence of death the whole time he was an inmate?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they treated him like his imprisonment on the ship, they treated him as though he were subhuman.
Right. That's a good... Oh, so you've read the narrative then? Yeah. It's all in the narrative. Another interesting, now that you mention that, is, and I didn't bring the quote, but the way he used the word happiness struck me as very odd, because he mentions when they had him in shackles on this boat. Now, here he is, captive. He's being taken away to prison. He's in very painful shackles. And he says, at a certain point in the voyage, they relieve me of my shackles, which greatly increased my happiness. Happiness. How can you be happy? And then I realized that happiness, the way they used to use it, and this is important for the Declaration of Independence too, meant freedom from pain and suffering at that moment. You were happy if you were... Now, we use it in a much more amorphous sense of, you know, you got to be happy.
Ecstasy,
yeah. Mm. But for them, it was relief of the... He actually used that sentence. It greatly increased my happiness, and I was thinking, how could he be happy? And and he uses that a couple of times in the narrative. The way, and he uses happiness in this sense too. The Vermont Constitution is different than U.S. because we have, and I know you're aware of this. The line there is. Pursuit and attaining of happiness, not just the pursuit of happiness. So we in Vermont, we go one step further. We actually get it, you know. But what we were getting in the 18th century sense of the word was freedom from present pain and suffering. That made a person happy. In which case, for us, all of us should be
delighted.
Yeah, because we're not in shackles, you know, and we're not weighted down. So happiness is sort of a natural state which you can achieve by freeing yourself from the encumbrances, which might be shackles physically or mentally, the mind-forged manacles that William Blake talks about. but a state of freedom. And he says that the opening lines of that narrative, ever since I was a young, it almost begins like this: ever since I was a young man, I have always put great faith or great, I'm not sure exactly how to express this, but liberty was my major concern since I was a young man. Liberty was the primary driving force in my life, whatever. I don't have that in front of me, but that's how he opens the narrative there. And I think a really astute reader would read the narrative and Reason, the Only Oracle of Man together, sort of, because one gives the idea of his stoicism.
Well,
you should have come an hour earlier and listened to this.
So, let me make yourself what I think. So let me ask a question then. So now we take the we're living in the 21st century, and we're in this postmodernist world, and at least some of us would think it's a postmodernist world. And now we're looking back on Ethan Allen and the folks of the American Religious Enlightenment. What effect has it had on what is its lasting effect on the religious movement of this country?
What's the lasting effect
of the Enlightenment as we understand it, looking back? What's the lasting effect? I mean, I have an answer, but I want to hear it.
Well, maybe we should start with your answer.
Well, I think the aftermath of the Enlightenment is our secular pluralism, and the American civil religion that gets confused for some sort of expression of spirituality would be my answer.
It's the expression of idolatry.
Right.
So
right.
You have a sort of a pejorative view then.
I do.
Yeah. Well, I don't think my view would be as pejorative, because I think it's part of the natural progression of human consciousness to dare to know and to throw off those strictures which inhibit us from knowing. And so it does create a polarity between those that are holding on to an old worldview, mm-hmm. and those that are willing to, you know, go it on their own, as mm-hmm. it were. But we don't hold on to the old cosmology at all. I mean, the three-tiered right. universe, right. nobody believes in that anymore, I don't think. And
there's probably somebody in Montana.
Yeah, a website.
or think that, you know, it's all a lie about, like, they're putting around these national parks, like the Grand Canyon, an alternative view of how the Grand Canyon was created, which
yeah.
I just think is absurd. I mean, to me, the magnificence of the, and this goes to the doctrine of evolution as well, the magnificence of that view of nature, it dwarfs the other view of creationism, I think. But the key is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, to maintain this kind of reverence to natural order and natural law that mm-hmm. you get out of the Enlightenment. That they lost that in France, and there you got the reaction and the Jacobins and all of the bloodshed.
See, and I would contend we've lost it here too.
Well, we're in danger of losing it, I think, for sure.
I think it's done.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris, though? That's the problem.
That is the problem.
Yeah.
Right. And I think part of the living out of the problem are these what's this? Not creationism. It's whatever they're calling that new. Which is the new movement, which is putting the signs up.
Oh, design.
Intelligent design. So yeah. Just get out that graph paper and, you know. But I mean, I think part of the backlash, I mean, this is why I think it's kind of dead, because I think part of the backlash is this whole intelligent design thing, which is using also the same characteristic that says, well, it's important to know.
Yeah.
And one person's truth is another person's fiction. And so here's the intelligent design people, and they're saying, okay, it's not Darwin. And it's not, you know, here's how it works. And so I think in large measure,
you know, I mean, I am being pessimistic about this whole thing, but I think in large measure, I think that's been the effect of as we experience today and of the Enlightenment is now anybody with a website or a 2 cents and something to say throws an idea out there, and because of our media hungry culture and 24 hour a day needing to know what's going on, these ideas get picked up, moved around the globe as if they're the truth,
right?
And so the old stricture of orthodoxy, for instance, if we could use that, you know, there used to be a fence around what was sacrosanct.
Yeah.
Well, there's no fence.
No fence. No boundaries anymore.
There are no boundaries.
Right.
And you could say one thing, and I could say another thing, and we could both circumnavigate the globe on the internet, and you're as right as I am. Which is a relatively good thing when one looks at things critically. When one is a part of the masses, the great unwashed, then...
That's a real enlightened statement.
Yeah. I have one comment to make about this, and that is the way in which this is so strongly an evidence of the post-Cartesian view of science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the... it's interesting to me that the natural religion or naturalism in looking at the world is very much the way that I think that medicine at UVM College of Medicine and here is practiced and taught. And that is a very strong sort of... until recent years, perhaps, a sort of neglect of the spiritual dimension and or discounting of it. But at the same time, I think that there is also almost a parallel with Ethan Allen's notion of immortality.
Hmm.
And that is that I don't experience even the most scientific of physicians necessarily discounting that there is a sense of immortality.
Right.
It's just that in the practice of discerning what we believe to be hard evidence truth, that one must have, you know, sort of only the natural laws will prevail. But that doesn't mean that folks still don't believe in something beyond. Right. And there is that same disconnect, I think.
Yeah.
And here we are as folks in chaplaincy who are saying, well, there's something else that can be experienced even now, rather than, you know, in this next life. And, you know, I think that in some ways we go between physicians who also believe that and then other physicians who would simply discount it. Mm-hmm. And so we have an uneven experience of physicians in the institution, because we will come across some who will sort of say, oh, you know, off with you, you know, this is, you know, a waste of time. And others who do have a belief. But even the ones who don't necessarily believe that we have much to offer in terms of the actual treatment of patients still believe that we have a value.
Oh, yes.
Many of them still, even though they would be atheists, would still believe that we have a value.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of interesting, I mean, it's the same sort of disconnect.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, because I don't want to take up your time your comments there when they opened the PACU pre-op, where you brought in technology and all the people that were going to be helped, and that brought in the spiritual dimension, too. I think that's exactly in sync with this, you know, and it definitely does have a role to play here, for sure. Mm. And I have an answer to all of your questions, but I got to go now. So you can have a copy of this. This is what we've been discussing. Ethan Allen as a product of the Enlightenment on the shores of Lake Champlain. It's been a great time. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, thank you.